inspired, on fire, hot wired, downward facing broad.
And so I don't have any hobbies. I mean, I eat lunch. That's all I like. No, seriously. Let's go out for lunch. I love it. But I hate my friends who are older now. They're like, oh my gosh, look at this food. We won't need any supper. Why are you saying that? Why do you say that? Nobody's following you home to watch. Of course you're going to eat supper, you... So I've got two hobbies, lunch and supper.
I had so much fun recording that bit that you heard. It was for a comedy special I did for CBC right before COVID. And we did it over at a little theater. And people had to come up three flights of stairs, but it was just the perfect audience, right? I think audiences are always better if they have to almost die getting to the place. And the whole show was about me freaking out. I was turning 60 and I thought, oh my gosh, all my friends are retiring and I don't want to retire. I mean, I don't want to be put out to pasture. I wanted to work less though, but I don't know how much less. And I don't want to stay too long because, like, what if I stay too long and then, you know, I just forget the whole show one night and I'm like the fat Elvis just standing on stage, like, well, you don't want to go like that. And so people are giving me all these tips of things I can do. Like, I could go to Stratford and I could buy a scarf. And they were telling me I had to travel. And I don't know. This was even before COVID. But honestly, I'm not really into travel that much. I've been on the road for 40 years. And frankly, flying sucks. It just, like, you never know if you're going to get there. The plane is canceled. And then you have to go through security. Of course, I'm always paranoid. They're gonna, you know, think I'm... you know, stealing something. And of course, at my age, they just wave me through. What could she be smuggling? Fruit, which I am because I need the fiber. Anyway, as the years have unfolded, I find my day wonderful. It just has so many beautiful little things I like doing. But back then I was really struggling with what this latter phase of my life was going to look like. And I think you're really going to like our guest today because she has certainly figured that out. She's an elder, a philosopher, an activist, and I'd love you to welcome Shemaho Goodenough. Well, good afternoon, Shemaho. Glad you could make it here today, all the way from BC. Shemaho Goodenough, I'm so glad you're here.
I'm glad I'm here too.
Yeah. I just want to let our listeners know that you are from British Columbia, Canada, which is the western side of Canada, and you live in a space called...
The Kootenays.
What's it called? The yes. Kootenays, in a town called Castlegar. Yes. And you've lived there for a long time, right? Like, since
I've
when?
Been in the Kootenays since 1970.
I want to let our listener know a couple of things about you before we start. In the middle of COVID, somehow CBC played a special of mine and mentioned my writing workshops, and I got a bunch of people from all over Canada to sign up, and one of the most amazing people was you, Shemaho, and I got to know you, and we really connected over your stories and over the Zoom class. So I really appreciate you taking the time today out of your schedule of, and you're a very busy woman. You've got more hobbies than the average bear. Castlegar is a small village or small community, and I wondered, in one of the stories that you wrote during the class, you mentioned it is a place you call your retirement home. What did you mean by that exactly?
Well, just to elaborate a bit on the hobby thing, I live by myself and I have to stay engaged or I get quite depressed. And it's something I think that anybody as they age, you run into this wall almost of the ways in which a person stays active and engaged as they age and really don't want to. So I kind of make myself do these things. And the reason I said that Castlegar is my retirement home, it's the whole city. It's not a very big city. But when people go into retirement homes, their basic needs are met. And my basic needs are met by this whole little town. So I can go swimming or I can go shopping. There's people to visit. There's church. There's ukulele class. There's just various activities. And of course, we have a climate change group and different political things to be involved in so that so I keep my joints liquid.
And your brain, your brain, yes. Liquid. Yeah, I know you're very busy because it took us a while to get scheduled because you were like, no, not that day. I'm busy, not that day. So it's great that you're active like that. So, you know, that's your home now. And obviously the city itself you've been around in a long time. Can you tell us where you were born and what home was like back there?
My parents are from the southern United States, and basically they moved up north during the Second World War. So I was born in 1946 in Cincinnati, Ohio, but soon my family moved to a little place called Brentwood that was near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and that's where I grew up.
And was that a rural area as well?
I would say no, it wasn't rural. It was a neighborhood, but we did play in the woods. We walked to school. We walked home for lunch. You know, it was a neighborhood, a borough, it was called.
How did that upbringing shape you as the person you became over your life? Like, how did that, you know, what was that doing to you and for you?
Well, I think one thing about it was that we got to organize our time ourselves. Well, I say at the kids in the neighborhood. And so it was, you know, because we walked to school and walked home, we did that as a small group, different kinds of small groups over the years. And after school too, so the kinds of games and whatnot that we played, they were fairly creative, I think. In one way, you know, just like building forts in the woods or little dams. I loved making little dams out of the water and mud pies and things like that. So it was a hands-on outdoor existence, and it is the way I like to be.
And it's funny, you still are that person, except you're organizing your own time rather than wait for people to come in and save you. So when you moved to where you are now in the 1970s, did you get married in that
I got
area?
Married before I came. At the time that I came across the border, you could emigrate at the border, which is what I got married, and my husband and I, you had to accumulate points to get across the border. And so you needed 50
really?
Points. So I had a union card, he had a union card, we both spoke English. There was various things that would give us 5 points.
What's a union card?
If you belong to a union, you get a card. Yeah, and that gives you points. People in unions, they tend to be good workers.
So you came across the border with your husband, and then he went up to work. Where were you when he was up working far away when you found out you were pregnant?
So he worked at that time in the logging industry. He worked for, at that time, what we had most of the woods in BC was what's called gypo loggers. And they were guys that basically had their own business because they bought their own equipment and they hired their own help and whatnot.
And he was away quite a bit?
Quite a bit, yeah.
I'm kind of leading you into a story I'd like to hear. I loved your story that you wrote in the class about when you found out you were pregnant. You were like this fierce mama bear
who really didn't want to be pregnant. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that story, how fierce you became as a woman?
I didn't think of it as fierce, but maybe I would be seen that way. For me, it was just what the next thing I had to do in order to take care of this child.
Well, the first thing was that you really weren't thinking you'd want a child.
No, I didn't want a child. Right? I really didn't. You know, and it's interesting, like my sister never had babies. My brother, he didn't want babies, but he did adopt. Like, I think our childhood home was very traumatic, actually, for a lot of reasons that you don't need to know about. And I think the example our parents gave us made us not think that that was a good thing to do, to have kids. I actually thought if I had a kid, I'd kill it.
Somehow, in that moment when you found out you were pregnant, you made a decision to keep it. And was that some kind of calling inside of you, or do you not know what happened back then when you said yes to having a baby?
Yeah, I do think that it was like, okay, this child chose me, so I must be good enough. And so you can see how that foreshadows me changing my name to Good Enough. And it was 2012, I changed my name legally to Good Enough. And
oh, wow, that's amazing.
But it is what, you know, I just thought, okay, this child chose me because I didn't try and have a baby. And so there's something very special for us.
If you could walk me through, so you decided to have the baby, you had a dog that was a bit of a handful, so you gave that dog to someone that could give it its attention,
yeah,
right? And then you went to town because you were too far out in the country.
Yeah, but town was Argenta, Argenta was on the other side of Kootenai Lake from Nelson. If you go up Nelson, there's Nelson, then you go up to Caslow, then you go up to the head of the lake, and you go across, and you end up in Argenta. And there's no store, no gas station. No, it was just a collection of little farms or little homes in the woods. So that's where I moved.
And then what did you do? You built what?
Well, we built a little log house there. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And was that you and your husband, or was that the person that helped you birth the baby?
No, that was me and my husband. Yeah. The house wasn't ready before the baby was. So I actually had made a teepee, and the baby was born in a teepee there right next to where we were living.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just a teepee. Oh, yeah. I'm not fierce. The baby's born in a teepee. And who helped you deliver the baby? I know all the answers to these questions, so I just want you to paint the picture for the listener, because it's just wonderful.
You know, there was, at that time, there wasn't any midwives, and actually the doctors were pretty sexist, I'll put it that way, because and I had a friend, Ruby, and Ruby was Hawaiian. And she had given birth to her baby with her husband, Hank. So she said, you know, Hank will help you. And I said, okay. And then there was my friend Josie, who was just a good friend. And we got a book. We got books to read. And I listened to, or we practiced the breathing techniques and just various things that they suggest you practice for when it's time to have the baby. And I'll tell you, Deb, like for me, if there's something goes wrong, I don't want to have a doctor to blame, is the way I felt about it. I just, in certain ways, I guess I know myself. And, I think blame is one of the worst interactive things that goes on in the world. And if I just didn't want to have a doctor to blame. So I wanted to do it myself.
Yeah, blame is a terrible thing to live with, yeah, too, isn't it? It's a big energy, yeah, sucker. It takes up so much of your creativity and your energy for, yeah, life, right? So you're not a fierce woman. You're just a woman who went to town, built a teepee, had a baby with a guy who was a midwife. But other than that, yeah, I'm fine. So life goes on. You've got this son who's now grown. He's got his own life. And the name of this podcast is Downward Facing Broad. And I just want to backtrack for, okay, 1 minute, is that you said that you were connected to the spirit world as a child, probably not, perhaps not knowing what it all meant, but you had been called to live in a space like Castlegar. Is that how that story went?
Yes, I think I have always been
connected. In the dream?
Yes. I've been guided, you know, from the time I was very young, I was guided from the supernatural, let's just call it the supernatural world. That I would get messages. When I got older and started being taught how to use medicine, then I could direct things better.
So let's talk about that. You sort of had this ability, but because of the trauma in the family and because you were just being moved from one thing in life to the next, it wasn't really, you didn't have all that information of how to ground it and utilize it. So you told me that you'd like to talk about, was it a medicine wheel?
Yes, I did.
What was going on first before you went to that kind, yeah, of, was it a ceremony?
So I was part of a group that called the Kootenai Players that did spiritual plays. And we had done a play called The Awakening, which was actually, I think, a very brilliant play. And after that, on the winter solstice, when this fellow called Red Cloud, who lived up in Enderby, Red Cloud came and he asked us to do a play. He said he wanted to bring back the medicine wheel. Like, all of the medicine practices had been outlawed for all Native people. So most people didn't practice drumming, singing, dancing, smudging, all these different ceremonies. And he wanted to bring these practices back because it was, in fact, legal now, but people had lost the training. And so we agreed.
And what year was that?
It was 1982. So Romeo was
right,
9, 10, and I was,
yeah. That's your son?
Yeah, the light of my life.
How did that change your mothering and how you approach things after the medicine wheel? Like, what kind of experience was that for you?
Well, I'm not sure it changed my mothering because I had from the beginning raised him traditionally. You know, starting with the teepee, I guess, and I had a papoose to carry him in, and just the way we lived was as traditional as I could get it without being on a reserve. And I'm not First Nations, but I am Métis. I'm not First Nations because I wasn't born in Canada, right? Mm. But I mean,
right?
We just call ourselves Native Americans or Indians. From the States,
right. And what was your was it Métis was the original name?
I don't know. I mean, my mom kept it a secret.
Like, okay,
it was illegal to be an Indian.
Of course,
people can't quite get that without some of that blood. I think, you know, it's like it's incomprehensible that it would be illegal to be an Indian, but it was. You know, it's just like if a First Nations woman married a white guy, she would lose her status. Her children would lose their status. People are starting to get those things back now, but the loss is permanent.
Yeah. So this took you on a new path, that first medicine wheel ceremony that you went on? Is that started a new chapter, or did it just reaffirm what you already knew intuitively?
It focused it and directed it, because then I was... So when we went up there, we went to camp. We went a week before we were actually going to do this play in the arbor. And so like when he came in the solstice and asked us to do it, and then he visited us, probably 6 weeks later with this fellow Sun Bear who was going to actually conduct the ceremony. And then we started creating this play at the equinox, the spring equinox. So March, April, May, June, we worked on this play so that we could perform it in the arbor and it was going to be on the solstice. And this was the first time that this medicine wheel ceremony and these medicine people all came up mostly from the States. And when we got there, we just wanted to practice in that arbor and set up. So we got there on a Tuesday. On Thursday, and I mean, it was typical bush in BC, so it was full of mosquitoes and flies and bugs and stuff. So there was a bunch of medicine people drove in on Thursday, and they set up, they did a few ceremonies, and then the mosquitoes were gone. The mosquitoes were gone until they left.
Are you kidding? Oh my gosh.
There's a tremendous amount.
I wish.
We are one, Deborah.
I know. I wish you could come to Toronto and get the bees out of here. We got so many wasps. So they came. So that must have been extremely powerful, that kind of focus, energy, and community coming together.
Absolutely.
For that weekend.
Absolutely. I remember, we had dance. There was so much going on with these medicine people, and just being around them, watching them, and interacting. And we also decided, okay, after that, we were going to get together 5 or 6 times a year to develop these skills. And that's what we did. There was people, you know, in various spots along the border on the American side and on the Canadian side. And we did. We got together 5 or 6 times a year for years to learn more and to develop our skills.
Is that something you do on your own now because you've been trained, or like, I don't know enough about this to ask I just wonder, are you a medicine woman in your mind? Is that what you'd be called?
Well, people would call me that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's been some fairly remarkable things happen.
I know. I feel that even on Zoom, how powerful you are and the influence you have on the class. And the wisdom that you've brought to your stories and to the class, and playing your piano for Mother's Day. It was wonderful. So let's skip ahead to 2012 and talk about why you changed your name. First off, you could tell us what your name was and why you changed it to, was it just the last name you changed?
Well, so I was born Jeffy Suzanne Bedsole, and I was named Jeffy Suzanne. My dad's name is Jefferson. And as you know, in the South, a lot of times that's the way they name the girls after the man. But, and I guess I'll tell you a little bit about my upbringing. When I had 2 older brothers, quite a bit older. And I remember when I was a kid asking my mom, how come I was named after dad instead of one of the boys? And she says, well, we had a friend in Memphis, and her name was Jeffy, and she had a daughter named Suzanne, and we loved them so much, that's what we named you. And okay, that didn't make a lot of sense to me, but you know, you have to, when you're a kid, you accept what you're told. And when I got married, the night before I got married, my mother says to me, well, she says, Jeffy, I have a confession to make to you. I went, oh, no. And she told me she'd been married before, that the boys had a different dad.
Oh,
and
wow.
So they were somehow gotten to shut up because they could never tell it. And it was this huge secret, you know, and I mean, it was just dumbfounded. So when I'm going down the aisle the next day getting married, I'm thinking I'm dad's firstborn. I'm on his arm and, you know, and it just like, I felt like she really took my, my glory from that day. She took it from me. I mean, she, for, because she could have told me later. She didn't have to tell me the day before I was getting married. She just, but she had held that so long, she had to dump it. Anyway, my mother was, had mental health issues.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Okay, so I was Jeffrey Sue Betts. So then when I got married, I was Jeffrey Sue Graham. Then when I was in Colorado, this was before I ever met my husband, and somebody had written me a note, and they spelled it J-E-P-H-I, and then for the Sue, they spelled it S-I-O-U-X. And I thought that was so cool that I just started spelling my name that way. And when I got a divorce, I got that as my legal name, Jeffy Sue. And so then...
Oh, wow.
I had an initiation in, I think it was 1996. I had an initiation and was given the name She Who Sings the Memories Home, which is shortened to Shemaho.
Oh my gosh, that's beautiful. Say that again.
She Who Sings the Memories Home. Because I am a singer and a drummer, you know, like I, that's my strong thing.
Hmm. Oh, I love this. And it's so interesting how a name empowers you or it takes away your power.
Yeah.
Just spelling it a different way, it seems like it's a whole other personality or something. So you get to 2012 and then you decide to go to Good
Enough. I'd read a book. I mean, in the 70s, I'm sure I read that book in the 70s, but there was this biologist from England mentioned, her name was Linda Goodenough. And I just thought, that's such a cool name, you know? And I just remembered it all those years. I just thought, what a great last name. And it is, because people don't hear Goodenough enough. Most things only have to be good enough, right?
What if you were a woman and you had to hyphenate your name, but your husband's name was enough, so you would be good enough enough? That would be like... I love it. Oh, this is an amazing story. And you certainly are good enough in my eyes. My gosh, I just love talking to you. A couple more questions. We have to wrap it up in a minute here, but you have gone through a lot, and the name of the piece is called Downward Facing Broad, where sometimes we get kicked down by life. But what do you do to keep your sense of humor or get it back when you get depressed? I know obviously you're active, but is there a way you get in touch with, like, the medicine of humor?
Right. Well, sometimes I do have to give myself a good swift kick. I have to get outside. If I get outside, then things change. It just,
me too.
Get outside and something will happen. You know, like, to relate to people, I love to just be loving out in the world. And that's very, very easy. You just smile at people that, you know, have an interaction that is, it, you don't have to know the person necessarily. But, and it's just like our conversation here, that'll give me a boost for a while. It's just lovely to talk with you, Deborah.
Yeah. And it's sometimes when you're really kicking yourself and being so dark and depressing, I can get a sense of humor from how repetitive my thinking is. Like, I'll be happy at 9 a.m. and then I'm babbling on about how awful thing is by noon. And I have a dog here, and I sometimes look at him and think, how is he looking at me? Like, what? Like, minute she's laughing and then she's crying. that perspective, eh? That helps you get a little bit of a smile back. You know, I just wondered, what kind of medicine do you think is needed most right now in the world? It's such a turbulent time environmentally, and there's just so much division of
yeah. Well, I think being kind, and you know, one of my bylines, so to speak, is God is smarter than we are. And there's always more I don't know mm-hmm. than I do know. So I remember these mm-hmm. things that I feel purposeful, Deborah. I feel, and I do understand the idea that the only meaning we have in life is the meaning we give it. So, but I also think that we are a meaning-making animal. Like I know that metaphor is really, I see metaphor everywhere. And so to engage in what's right before you is very helpful. And I think knowing you don't know much. Like if people are yeah. so sure of and unwilling to learn. And I mean, since we're talking, like, it's just like that fellow that's the opposition in Parliament. The way he talks, I just, you know, he's so positive and he blames. And it's discouraging that people listen to it instead of just telling, why don't you just sit on and shut up?
yeah, and I thought, and when they want to take over people's countries, what they do is they play toxic messages over microphones, yes. like in when they, you know, they invade, yes. right? They put propaganda yes. out. And I thought, that's what we do today is we just listen to propaganda, but we're the ones paying actual cash for listening to propaganda. Like we're very silly because you go, just stop looking at it because it's not the truth. You know, there's a bigger picture here. Well, we do have to sign off. Oh my gosh, I could talk to you all day. I love the phrase, I think we should end on this, is the only meaning we have in life is the meaning yeah. we give it. Yeah. So beautiful. Thank you so much, Shemaho. I will see you in November on the class, and I look forward to some new stories. And what was that song you sang?
Oh,
what was that little ditty you
right,
sang?
Right, and that actually did, that's...
Oh, it was on the piano. Yeah. It was so cute.
And it actually was one I got Evelyn Eaton. She was one of the medicine people there, and it was something that she had said to me, which was, whichever way it goes, may I fulfill the mission I was sent here to do. May I be brave, may I be straight, may I be shining. Whichever way it goes, may I fulfill the mission I was sent here this time to do. May I be brave, may I be straight, may I be shining. Whichever way it goes, may I fulfill the mission I was sent to. What's time to do? May I be brave, may I be straight, may I be shining. Whichever way it goes, may I fulfill the mission I was sent here. It's time to do. May I be brave, may I be straight, may I be shining.
Oh my goodness, I love Shemaho. When she was speaking, all I could think, I want to be Shemaho when I grow up. She has so many words of wisdom to share, and I'm sure you picked up on a lot of them. So if you'd like to comment, please do. And also you can share with others or follow or subscribe, or you can check me out in the show comments. There's lots of links there to my site and my books. And we'd really like you to engage a little bit because we'd love to know if you're there and you're listening. For me, I'm going to take Shemaho's advice.
and go outside. I always feel better after I go for a walk. I always feel better in the fresh air and the sunshine. And I want to remind you, as she said, you're good enough, even if it's not your last name. And even when you're not a perfect person, like this next comedy clip. Until next time. So what am I going to do if I retire? What am I going to do? What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Do good? How many hours would that take? I've done good. I did the Meals on Wheels, but I ate the meal and well, it was lunchtime.
And she's a downward facing broad.